For members only, Golf Smarter number 284, published on May 24, 2011.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Johnny Miller's 63 at Oakmont, part two of Chasing Greatness.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Adam Lazarus, Steve Schlossman, welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only.
Happy to be here.
Good to be here.
And in that little break, you know, in our last episode of Golf Smarter, obviously you guys were setting up your book, Chasing Greatness, Johnny Miller, Arnold Palmer, and the Miracle at Oakmont, which, again, we urge everyone to get a copy of, whether they get the hardback, paperback, or Kindle version. It's all available on the Golfer's Mart at golfsmarter.com. We set the story up. We talked about the major players. We talked about the golf course. We talked about how you guys got together. And now we're going to talk about the tournament itself and lead into the final day when, and this is not a spoiler alert because this is history, when Johnny Miller shot an amazing 63. And I'm hoping that, Steve, now that you've, in the last 5 minutes, you've gone to the store and bought yourself a microphone for your Skype phone call, that you can read some of the segment of this book to us. And I think that more than anything, by sharing this story with, it's going to make it, make the audience, I know myself, that you're going to want to read this book. You're going to definitely want to get more out of it because it's such an amazing story, especially as we lead up to this year's U.S. Open. And if you've downloaded this after this year's U.S. Open, wasn't it great? Wow. What a story. What a comeback, huh? Did you ever think it would end up like that? No idea what I'm talking about. All right. So where should we begin, guys?
Well, I guess we'll start with round one. You know, Oakmont in 1973 had this kind of massive reputation to live up to. And there'd been debates over the years as to whether Oakmont was played harder when it was really wet and played longer and the rough was impossible to get out of, or whether it was really hard and fast and firm and the greens were as fast as they could be. Everybody knew that Oakmont's greens were the fastest in the United States. But if they tried to make them really, really fast, they could disqualify about 80% of the guys who played from even having a chance. And Nicklaus was the guy who said, I'd like them as hard as tabletops. Then there'd only be a few people who can compete with me. But they're always trying to kind of develop some kind of a compromise. And as they went into the Open at Oakmont, there'd been a lot of rain, but there'd been a lot of hot weather. And as day one opened, the course was dry. The greens were hard. The greens were fast. The rough was thick. And the end result, after the first day of play, was that the average score was 76.8, which was a full half stroke higher than the average score in the 1962 U.S. Open. So in 1973, as the Open began, Oakmont was actually playing harder than it had played in 1962, and it was just as dry, just as fast, and the guys were having fits. And then with all this high scoring, some kind of a voice from the past comes back. Gary Player, one of the big three from the early 1960s. Gary Player, who had just suffered through two surgeries a few months earlier, one for cancer. Back playing 15 pounds less than he normally was, and he was fit and thin to begin with, saying how badly he was going to do. He couldn't handle Oakmont. Well, he goes out, and he shoots a 67, which ties the course record at Oakmont that Ben Hogan had set in 1953. Nobody in 1962 had shot 67. So Gary Player comes up and shoots 67. Nobody else breaks 70. And so you have this remarkable first day where the Oakmont record has been tied at the same time, for a low score, has been tied at the same time that the course scoring average is higher than it had been in the previous U.S. Open. Adam, any comments on that you'd like to make on the first round?
Yeah, the first round, Player was the story from that day because he barely practiced at all and he hadn't played in a long time. I don't think he'd played in the tournament since the previous year because of his surgeries. I think it had been since, or maybe he'd played in one, but it had been since November since he had played a full tournament, I think. And so he was, by the end of the day, he was a big point, a big figure. And since it was Palmer at Palmer's quote-unquote home course, he was another big figure. But you came away from that first day, if you were watching that, you know, in today's time and you were watching SportsCenter, you still came away thinking about Nicklaus, because Nicklaus had had sort of a so-so round. He was hovering around par the whole day, and, you know, he's still Nicklaus. He had won four tournaments coming in that into the Open that year. He didn't win the Masters, so he wasn't chasing the Grand Slam like he was the year before. But Nicklaus comes – he plays a sort of so-so through the first 16 holes, and he comes to the 17th, which, if you know Oakmont, is this long uphill dogleg left. Correct me when I get wrong on the details here, Steve.
Well, it's a short par four rather than a long par four.
Yeah. The week leading up, people had asked if he was going to try to drive it, because they had lengthened it from – they had built a new tee because Nicklaus had been able to drive the green in 62. So a couple years later, when they were preparing to have the Open back in 73, they spent a lot of money – members at Oakmont spent a lot of money to make it too hard for anybody to drive. And someone said, I think it may have been the caddy master or someone, the pro at Oakmont, had said that you'd been crazy to try to drive it this year. And Nicklaus says that he just decides to try to drive it. And he goes and he drives it. He makes an eagle. He makes his putt, drives the green, makes his eagle putt, and goes into the end of the round. You know, I think he parred 18 with huge momentum to record what was, par 71, which is huge in the first day at Oakmont. 71 is a great score. So,
go ahead.
I was just going to say that, as much as he struggled almost the whole round, I mean, we've seen guys like Tiger Woods do this. As much as he was struggling the whole round, he comes out and he eagles the 17th, which no one even tries to eagle. And it's just vintage Nicklaus. And you go into day two and you think, oh, well, these other guys have had nice moments, but Nicklaus driving that green, if he can do that the rest of the day, he has a huge advantage over the rest of the field, and he's right in contention. You know, he's probably tied for fourth or fifth, just because no one else had shot besides players 67. Only a couple people had shot 70, so his 71 puts him right in the thick of things. And as much as anyone else, Nicklaus is the story, not surprisingly, at the end of day one.
Yeah, he's the story. And the thing about the end of the first day was that it was the cream really rising to the top. When you have an average score of 76.8, but right at the top of the leaderboard, you have Gary Player at 67, then Palmer, Nicklaus, Weisskopf, Trevino, all shooting 70, 71. Everybody whose name in those years is right up there at the top of the leaderboard.
And Raymond Floyd, too, who would
– Raymond Floyd, absolutely shooting 70.
Trevino shot a 72, and we'll get to Trevino's story length, but that was his first of three 70s. So all the big-time names were right there on top.
And what did Palmer shoot that day? And
where a 71.
He shot a 71, so he was like top four or five at that point.
Yep.
Yeah, fifth, I think, tied for fifth.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, so there were, so except for Player, you have maybe a dozen guys at 70, 71, 72, but including all the top players of the time, and that includes Weisskopf, who was on a streak of tremendous proportion. He'd won three of the last four tournaments he'd played in, and had finished second to Nicklaus in the fourth of those.
He hadn't been over par in over a month.
Right, he hadn't been over par in over a month, and he was playing with this extraordinary momentum and sense of seriousness, because he had the sense of trying to redeem himself for his dad. His dad had died a few months earlier. He always had profound guilt feelings of really never having tried hard enough, he felt, to realize his full potential while his dad was alive. His dad had always tried to tell him, you know, you could be as good as anybody if you really put the effort into it. And Weisskopf was really putting the effort into it in those few months after his father died, and was on this extraordinary streak that he would actually sustain for the rest of the year. Weisskopf won the British Open in the summer of 73. So Weisskopf was among this cast of stellar characters, including Nicklaus Palmer, and also including Johnny Miller, who wasn't playing that well tee to green, but was putting fantastically well, and I believe shot 71 or so. Adam, I'm not sure if I'm right about that.
Yeah, I think 70,
shot 71.
The
front end.
The one other thing I want to add about day one, and this sort of comes through it, it points throughout the rest of the book, but especially on the last day, is, you know, the key guys in the book are the Palmers and the Nicklauses and the Trevinos and the guys who stand out as the true icons of the game. But as later, as we got in the first part of that, in this, the listeners got in the first part of this segment, that John Schlee emerges as an interesting guy. But there are other people who, lesser known figures, and in that first day, we this is something I'll say for the readers to read the book, is the first guy who tees off in the early morning on Thursday has a nightmare start just from being late to the tee. And there's a few little anecdotes like that across the story of the book, with people who you don't know, but you know, you can sort of sympathize with them. The big moment of being at the U.S. Open and this 20 some year old kid teeing off and he's late to the tee. So there's a lot of interesting stories like that. So you pick up the book, you'll check that out.
Exactly. I have a couple quick questions. We're going to talk more about Schlee, because in that first last episode that we did together, you teased us about Schlee. Are you going to be able to cover some more of that in this conversation?
Sure, absolutely. But I think Schlee's best saved for the end.
Oh, great.
Of what he does.
Okay, because I'm really fascinated here. And actually, my second question, as we finish the first day of the tournament, there's no possible way that the media coverage then was is what we have today, with all 4 days being on network television, being covered from multiple angles and online and things. But what, at the time, what was the media coverage, and how was the public, how interested was the public, you know, the general public in this event?
Well, the television coverage was about two and a half hours on the Saturday and the Sunday. So you didn't have Thursday or Friday television coverage.
And there was only three networks at the time. I mean, cable really hadn't.
No, there was no. It was only ABC, right?
ABC, and ABC had a record number of television cameras there. What that number was around 15 or so cameras.
Yeah, it was like 17 or something.
17 cameras.
Wait, so and they were in fixed positions, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, fixed positions.
And they've been talking about how great slow motion was, I remember.
Absolutely. Slow motion was a big thing.
It was their first tournament with slow motion replays.
Wow.
And every so often the person in charge would put on the screen a certain hole, and the announcers would be trying to figure out what hole was on television. It was an early stage for television broadcasting, but it wasn't the dark ages either. And they were very proud of their 17 cameras.
So I'm guessing that if it was 1973 ABC, this is the Rune Arledge years, and the wide world of sports, and was Jim McKay being the announcer?
I remember Chris Schenkel and Byron Nelson were the anchors.
Okay, good.
Jim McKay was there.
But yeah, that's right.
Of course.
And Frank Gifford was one of the. I think he was like the 12th or 13th hole. Yep. Dave Marr too, right, Steve?
Yep. Dave Marr Senior, right?
Right. So you wouldn't have two guys sitting in a booth watching all monitors at once. You had specific guys at different cameras. Announcing various parts. So they didn't even get to talk to each other.
Chris Schenkel and Nelson were the guys. I think they probably just had someone in their ear telling what was going on. I can't be sure. They weren't – they were up in a – you know, like they have Jim Nance and Curtis Stranger, whoever does it now for CBS. That's how it was. And, you know, Miller and blanking on his name. They were sort of the anchors in the central. But they definitely had, I think, a couple guys at each of the later holes.
Right, and Keith Jackson was another one.
Yeah,
of the
Keith
people
Jackson
there.
Was great.
And
yeah.
Frank Gifford was actually. They had the first female announcer ever in a golf tournament. Marilyn Smith, LPGA co-founder.
Awesome.
Marilyn Smith was there, and I interviewed Smith, and she said she was so nervous, they put her with Gifford to calm her down, so that she wouldn't have to announce the hole alone.
No comment.
Yeah, right, exactly. And they got married and had three kids. Okay. I mean, to me, that always amazes me and intrigues me is the media end of it and, you know, how much it's grown and where it's gone to. But, boy, Rune Arledge really was a trailblazer.
Yeah, that was right at the time when Monday Night Football was coming out, too, so early
right.
70s.
Yeah, but let me, since you raised it in terms of media, though, you know, and just fast-forwarding to the final round, Johnny Miller came from very far behind. They didn't have cameras in those days on most of the front nine holes. The cameras didn't pick up Johnny Miller at all until he was on the 10th green.
Wow.
So there's limited TV coverage of them. But the other side of the story here that we should at least tell you is that, you know, this was a golden era for print journalism.
Mm.
So for all them, there wasn't on TV, there was massive amounts of national and local newspaper coverage at a time period when every town had, you know, several local newspapers, morning and evening editions. So there was a lot of attention being given to golf, but TV wasn't necessarily at the center of it like it is today.
So yeah, then you were getting the story the next day, mostly.
Yeah, yes. Well, that's what was sort of interesting. Steve just touched on it, that they don't get Miller till the 10th. I mean, there's no internet, obviously. So they, you turn on the TV and Miller had started six shots behind and he was in tied for 13th place. So anybody who turns on the TV at, you know, when he's already halfway done at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon and finds out that he's in the middle of a 63 and you know, tied, he's probably, when they turned on the TV, he was probably tied for second or third, I would say, just guesstimating. But, you know, they have to be, there's these people across the country turning on the TV and saying, how is Johnny Miller in this tournament? And that's one of the things that, it was a great quote in Sports Illustrated a few days later. Tom Weisskopf said something like, Johnny Miller, I had no idea he was even in the tournament. So there's this – I mean, that wouldn't happen today. You wouldn't turn on the U.S. Open because somebody would have checked ESPN. You would have done whatever. You would have looked –
somebody would have been tweeting it.
Yeah. You would have said, oh, he made a birdie here. He made a birdie here. He's going to get back into it. For Miller – because Miller birdied the first four holes. So when you turn on the TV on this Sunday – and see that, oh my God, Miller, he just leapfrogged 10 guys and he's in contention now. That's really what sort of gave that tournament it's a punch from right from the beginning of as soon as the network, you know,
So there was no real live coverage other than what was going on TV. Was there radio coverage? Was there anybody broadcasting on the radio, or is it just reporters?
Question. I don't think so.
No, we don't think so. There had periodically been radio coverage, but, you know, it never really worked, and I'm not aware of any radio coverage. But, you know, we have an interesting quote in the book. Johnny Miller's parents just turned on the TV just to see what was going on when it came on at 3:30 Eastern time, and they were shocked. They had no idea that their son was contending for the lead. And so they were just kind of riveted and nervous as all could be.
And were
didn't get out his cell phone after.
were they on the West Coast?
They were on the West Coast. Yeah.
Right. So then 12:30 on the West Coast. So they were just like Sunday afternoon. They probably just got back from church.
Yep.
Let's see how Johnny's doing. He had a terrible day yesterday. He shot 76. We know he's out of it, but they hadn't expected to see their son on TV. He was out of it, and so they were shocked to even see him on TV.
Oh, great. All right. Now I'm getting fired up. Day two. Let's turn the page.
Day two was a very different day. And we can't go into all the great detail, but I'll give you two basic facts that we portray in some depth. The first is that there is record low scoring at Oakmont, whereas before the average score was a half shot higher than in 1962, all of a sudden you have more guys shooting in the 60s than ever shot in the 60s in a single round in the U.S. Open. The weather is the same. It's hot. It's humid. It's dry. What's gone on? Okay, that's the first fact about day two, which is radically different from day one.
What was the average score that day?
The average score was a stroke and a half lower, so it'd be around about 74. Obviously, not everybody tore the course up, but a stroke and a half difference with the same set of players has to be accounted for in some way.
Yeah, low 75. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well,
and there's a low score. The second main fact is that there's a new record score shot. Gene Borak, an unknown club professional from New York, shoots 65, breaks the Hogan record of 67, that player had tied in the first round, and shoots 65. How can an unknown shoot 65 at Oakmont? Well, that's the big story. What's wrong with Oakmont on day two? And we were able to interview this unknown, Gene Borak, before he died. In fact, we did 6 hours of interviews with him, and we have all the details of how he shot the 65 that day. But those are the raw facts. The issue was for us, how are we going to explain this? Okay, is this something that's really historically significant? Is there any rational explanation? Adam, do you want to talk about that a little?
Well, I would say don't forget about Borak and his high school golfing buddy was John Voight, which is interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Which makes for a strange little pairing. that I mean, you feel like anytime you watch these majors, there's always some kind of guy who, from nowhere, who shoots a great round. But the thing with Borik was who he was amongst these others, and he had bailed himself out on a lot of these shots. And Steven, I think you're better equipped to discuss the larger course ramifications. But
sure,
it wasn't just Borik. I remember, you know, Bob Charles had a rough first day, and he comes out and has a fantastic second day too. The great left-handed golfer. So there are these moments, and there's another, you know, these, we keep coming back to these guys who, you know, these small names compared to Nicklaus and Palmer. But there was a guy named Jim Colbert who had a pretty good first day. Who's one of those guys who shot a 70 in the first day. And then in the second day, he keeps it going, and he shoots a 68, and he has a fantastic round, and he's actually just one or two shots behind Player at the halfway point. So I think that's just part of the magic of major championships, is that you have this odd mixture of the truly, like Steve said about the first round, the cream of the crop rising, but also these guys who just somehow manage to put together a few great shots, to play a few good rounds in a row and put themselves into contention. So it's really a great mixture of the tournament showing, you know, the big boys and these guys who are nipping at their heels a little bit. So that was something that, when you look at the, you know, the first day, you say one of the chapters we have the first day is the big three reborn, because Player, Palmer, and Nicklaus are the sort of the heroes of that first day. But that second day, there's a lot of guys who sort of make their noise and, you know, make a mark. And one of them is Gene Borik, who nobody knew, was just a club pro. He wasn't a regular tour player. And then you also have this Jim Colbert, who was a good player, he was a good player, but he's, you know, When you have Player, Palmer, Nicklaus, and you got Weisskopf being a giant at that time, and you have this guy Jim Colbert, who not many people knew, and fewer know today, to be right in contention with a 70 and a 68 is a pretty remarkable feat. So Steve will sort of address those larger issues of the course. Yeah. But when you look at the second day, that's...
It's also a historic testimony on why it's really dumb to get involved in a pool or betting when it comes to golf.
Yes. Now,
That's true enough, and what Adam was saying is all true. But let me go for kind of the more direct explanation for the low scoring.
Sure.
It turns out that there had been rumors at the time that many people denied, saying it was an urban legend. Others claimed it was true, but it happened another time. The long and the short of it is that that the best explanation for all of the low scoring in round two was that, totally unplanned, there was a mishap with the sprinkler system on the night before, that is Thursday night into Friday morning. And that, because they were concerned that with the hot weather and the greens being super fast anyway, they might lose the greens, they decided to order a 5-minute watering. Well, they're not quite sure what happened, and a lot of explanations or denials. Lightning had struck the sprinkler system. But anyway, the sprinklers, rather than running for 5 minutes, ran for about 5 hours.
All night.
Okay. And the people in charge of the tournament for the USGA didn't know about it until they went out to start placing the pins at around 4 a.m. And the ground was squishing under their feet, and the greens were all a mess. They were all wet. Anyway, this story was one that we were able to investigate and kind of get to the people who were there and get them to really kind of open up as to what really happened that day. And ultimately, the sprinklers made the greens so soft and slowed the greens for much of the day on Friday that the players going out there were all of a sudden able to pick up real quickly, hey, Oakmont is playing differently. We can start hitting for the pins a bit more. And that's what many of them did. Now, not all of them had the talent to do so. Not all of them could keep the ball in the fairway. Normally, Oakmont's fairways are tight and the rough is unbelievable. But if you were hitting it straight and you had a shot at the green, all of a sudden you could play at the pin in a way you would never dare try to do on the firm, fast, slanted greens of Oakmont. So we were able to kind of, without revealing too much of it right now, get at the truth of really what happened to make it possible for a scoring record of for the U.S. Open to be set on that second day, and perhaps to account for Gene Borik's 65, but more generally to account for the greatest number of rounds in the 60s ever shot in the U.S. Open to that point at Oakmont, of all places. So we detail the sprinkler controversy in some depth. And Gary Player still ends up at the end of the lead, atop of the leaderboard after day two. But the real story is why all these low scores.
Yeah, I want to add something about the sprinkler element. And, you know, this is something that we talked about in the earlier episode about memory being a little bit difficult when you're interviewing and talking to people about things that happened 40 years later and why the newspaper the next morning can be a better source for it. Some people over years have sort of conflated that sprinkler story with why Miller shot a 63 on Sunday. And there's been conjecture about when the sprinkler, someone we talked to remembered it earlier and some remembered it later. And years later, when the people talk about the Miller 63, some people do talk about the sprinklers having gone off that morning, which they didn't. They went off two mornings earlier. And I remember we did an interview with someone who said that they thought that Miller was playing with winter rules that round, and that's how he shot a 63. So there's a lot of sort of mystique and sort of mystery about that tournament, and the sprinkler element is one of them. And it's just sort of an interesting how these legends sort of grow, these tall tales, and the sprinkler element was certainly one of them.
I guess there's conspiracy theorists wherever you go.
Yes. Well, I guess when you shoot a 63 at Oakmont, that tends to happen.
Right. So anyway, that's the story of round two for us. It's a fascinating moment and one of the most challenging for us to reconstruct, to get beyond the myths and try to figure out what really happened.
Amazing. I'm sitting here listening. I'm ready for day three.
I guess we can start on day three. The thing that you know I would say about day three is the sprinkler issue was certainly something that contributed to day two, but it couldn't have been. The next day, it rained a little bit, and there was some wet weather, and the receptive greens continued, and there's some more somewhat surprising scores, and one of them comes from this young guy Jerry Hurd, who was really considered one of the early, you know, one of those young lions is what they called him, one of those guys in their mid-20s who had all the tools, who was expected to be the next Nicklaus or Palmer or whatever, and he has a great 66, which leads the first day. He's paired with this guy, John Schley, who's a total sort of tour journeyman, and he shoots a 67. So you've got these two guys who aren't Nicklaus and Palmer shooting the two lowest rounds. So they steal some of the majesty of the third day with great rounds. And I think there's a quote somewhere in there from Hurd after the round, which he shoots a 66. Because the greens were so wet still from the rain that morning, it was like throwing darts onto the greens that they just landed. So that sort of continued through the next day. But once again, the thing that stood out to me the most of the third day is that Palmer rises to the top. And he had sort of churned his way through the first two rounds with pairs of 71s. You know, par is great at Oakmont. It's not like you're playing a regular tour stop where you do 6-7 under par. So Palmer shooting back-to-back even pars is a big deal. But he goes out on the third day and has a great 68. And it's really the best round he says he's ever shot at Oakmont. It puts him right into a tie for the lead going into the final round. Nicklaus, by no small coincidence, has a really tough 74. And he talks about how he just couldn't get it going at all. So you have Palmer and these young guys, and then you also have another figure from the past who, you know, we talked about Player having a great first day. This Julius Burrows, who most people, you know, most golf fans know, but isn't part of that sort of elite group of golf heroes, Palmer, Nicklaus, and everybody, he's 40.
53.
He's 53 years old. He's 10 years older than Palmer.
Wow.
He's actually remains the oldest major champion ever. He won the PGA in 68. Is the oldest major, you know, when Watson almost won at the British Open and Couples was competing at the Masters 2 years ago. That was the record they were chasing was Burrows's 48 years old winning the PGA. But Burrows shoots a 68-2, and he was known for just being smooth and easy and just being great with his approach shots. And so his 68 marks this creates a four-way tie at 210, which is 3 under par. So you go into the final round, and Steve, you can backtrack on what you want to say about the third round. But you go into the final round with four guys tied at the top, and that's a sort of a log jam, and there's several right behind them. So this the third day sort of stands out to me as everybody making a push for it, and almost everybody getting there. So you have this, and you have this strange mixture of old and young, with Jerry Hurd, who's 26, and Julius Burrows is 53, and Palmer's 43, and John Schlee's 33. So you have these four generations of guys, which makes, you know, one of the things about the Open being so special is you have such a conglomerate of people, and that was what stood out to me in the third day, and something that was sort of made the fourth day even better.
Can I interject something for just a moment?
Sure.
You talk about the mixture of generations and you know, the different skill sets and whatnot. I just want to compliment you two on getting together and having the academic and a journalistic approach to this book from, you know, different viewpoints, different generations. I'm finding this so interesting, so fascinating, and I appreciate this story so much. Thank you. I just wanted to say that.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for the compliment.
And you know that those four – that's the first time in U.S. Open history that you had a four-way tie going into the last round.
Wow.
And it's four different generations, a 20-year-old, 30s, 40s, 50s. This is the most extraordinary kind of thing. But you know the other parts of that third day that I would want to mention – you know, third day is usually talked about as moving day on a golf course. People move up, people move down.
Right.
Well, we already talked about one of the people who moved, in a sense, down, Johnny Miller, who shot this 76 that day. Gary Player, in the lead, finally starting to tire, hadn't played much, was really recovering from very serious illness, shoots 77. So both of these guys seemingly shoot themselves out of any chance to win at a time when other guys, Hurd, Burrows, Palmer, Schlee, are shooting in the mid 60s and surging to the front. So it's a real lot of movement up and movement down. But let me, on something that Adam said earlier too, on the issue of wetness. Yes, there was some rain, some significant rain, actually early Saturday morning. And one of the most difficult subjects I think that golfers try to kind of talk about is, well, what impact does wetness have on a golf course? And here we just talked about the second round, where the dramatic overwatering of the greens for most of the day on Friday helped slow the greens, made them more receptive, and probably contributed to some record low scoring. Well, come Saturday morning, you get rain over the entire course. Well, might you expect to see even lower scoring? Not at all. In fact, the average scores on Saturday, even though Hurd shoots 66, Schlee 67, Palmer and Burrows 68, the average scores on Saturday actually climbed to the highest of any time during the entire tournament. So I think there's all kinds of complications when you try to assess the impact of wetness on a golf course and whether it necessarily makes it easier or harder. I would say when only the greens were softer on Friday and they were much more receptive than even on Saturday, that yes, it had a big impact on scoring. But when the whole course becomes wetter and the rough that's already difficult becomes thick, and guys are trying to figure out, well, how fast is this green really? It's just rain, but it looks like it's drying out, and this part's being exposed to the sun and that part isn't. It can become a problem, and I think proof was in the pudding here in the fact that the highest scores of the entire tournament were registered on the Saturday. So
I'd like to add about that.
Good.
I'd kind of like to talk about Miller and dovetail that with the start of the fourth round. You know, you talked about Miller 76. So just to bring everybody up to speed, Miller had two really good rounds the first 2 days. He was at 140. So I think he was three or four shots behind. He was going into the third day. So he was really in contention. I think he was tied for fourth or tied for third. And he has a nightmare on Saturday. He shoots a 76, which is bad, and not quite as bad as we'd really make. He sort of suggests years later. There's another one of these little mystical side stories, anecdotes that come out regarding Miller 76. He says, you know, Miller he was married, he had two young kids, he was staying at a house in Oakmont. And he says that he forgot his yardage booklet. And Steve, you can speak to whether
for the third round that he forgot it.
you can speak to whether or not the third, the, how much we can really put into the yardage booklet costing him a 70, causing a 76. But so he says he forgets his yardage booklet. His wife races to, somehow he got a message to her, races to the, races home, picks it up for him, brings it to him in the 10th tee. And he still does it. He has just as bad a round with the yardage booklet as he did without it. So, you know, a lot of Miller, the sort of the tall tale part of Miller's story is that, you know, oh, I shot the 76 because of the because I didn't have my yardage booklet. And we're not sure that that was quite exactly how it shaked out. I don't know, Steve, if you want to jump on that. But I would like, you know, that sort of that 76 is paramount to the story and how why Miller's next round is so historic and so special.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things we're trying to do as a serious trying to tell a real narrative dramatic sports story, but to ground it on historical fact, is never to accept anybody's recount of something as absolutely true if there's contradictory evidence. And here we were able to come upon some stories where Miller was alleged to have shot 41 on the front nine and 35 on the back, 35 on the back after he had his yardage book in hand. And then all I did was go down to the basement of Oakmont Country Club and look at the scorecards that they had posted there and said, no, he didn't shoot 41-35. He actually shot 38-38. And then we probed further and found
– one below on the back nine, so cars one less on the back nine, yeah.
So he actually shot worse, what, three over par on the back nine versus two over par on the front. So the explanations of why he may have shot 76 on the front nine having something to do with the yardage book, if so, it's a little hard to figure out why it would work out that with the yardage book in hand, he actually shot worse on the back nine than he did on the front nine. So these are small things, but part of the larger truth-telling effort that we're trying to ground this dramatic narrative in. But the one thing for sure is that whatever the explanation of Johnny Miller's 76, the next day he thought for sure he was out of the tournament. He told his wife to just stay and pack up. We're going to the next tournament in Akron as soon as possible. The moment I step off the 18th green, please come pick me up. We got to get out of here. And we happened to interview somebody who drove him to the course that day, and all he was doing was mumbling about how badly he'd played and how he didn't have a chance as he went into the final round. So we had no expectations whatsoever, and that's how we begin our story of the final round.
Which is sort of, if you think about it, explains one of the reasons why Miller – you know, he had an earlier start than all the leaders because he was six behind and there were 12 or 13 guys ahead of him. So he was starting just about an hour or so, more than that, I think, ahead of the final group. So, you know, he thinks he's out of it. And you can, if you look at it, yes, it's, you know, I cost myself a shot at the tournament with a 76 and he was mumbling to himself. But it really did free him of those final round pressures a little bit because he was so far behind. It wasn't like watching Rory McIlroy at the Masters this year because, you know, there were so many ahead of him. He had such a long haul to make up that he could just play all or nothing. And that's what happened. He birdies the first four holes at Oakmont, which is crazy. And that gets him right back into the thick of things. And just as a side note, you know, some people have sort of disparaged Miller's round of 63 as not being the greatest for that reason, because he was so far behind, he didn't have to play with that final round pressure. That may have been true for the first couple holes, but as soon as he birdies the first four holes, he's right atop the leaderboard. I think he's, you know, two or three shots back, and his, you know, he was in contention. So any thought that, you know, he played that whole round, like if he was the first guy off the tee and he was done while he was in the clubhouse while the other guys were at the first tee is nonsense. So he had plenty of pressure on the back nine and knew he was in contention throughout that back nine and really throughout the end of the front nine. So while there wasn't pressure the moment he got onto the tee, the first tee, by the, you know, an hour into it, he was feeling that, you know, U.S. Open final round being in contention pressure.
Yeah, let's set the scene a little bit here. You're going into the last round. You've got a four-way tie for the lead, okay? So that's unusual to begin with. Then you've got Nicklaus, Trevino, Weisskopf, Bob Charles, a whole bunch of major championship winners right behind them. Everybody's attention is focused on these guys who are teeing off toward the end, because there are so many great players among them, in addition to the young lion, in Jerry Hurd, in addition to John Schlee. It's mainly top of the rank players, and you're figuring they're going to fight it out amongst themselves, with Palmer right in the mix and that, you know, being very motivated. Miller is tied for 13th with three other guys. He's teeing off around 70 minutes ahead of everybody else. And the way Elkmont works, after you play the first hole, the Pennsylvania Turnpike kind of bifurcates the course, and you go off onto the other side of the course for the next seven holes. And a lot of fans never kind of cross the bridge and just stay on the home side, kind of. Well, Miller birdies the first hole, hits a great drive. It's very wet. Ball doesn't go too far on the fairway. He has to hit a full three iron in, which he stops 5 feet from the hole, makes the birdie putt. Then he crosses over the turnpike, puts a nine iron to 1 foot away on the second hole. Then he plays a very difficult third hole, known to, if you ever see pictures of Oakmont, you'll see the big bunkers on the left called the church pews. Plays the church pew hole and sinks his only long putt of the round, a 25-footer. Then he birdies the next hole, a par five, by almost sinking an eagle sand shot. Well, he's played four holes. Palmer, Nicklaus, Weisskopf, all those guys are still, they're on the practice putting green. Okay, they don't have any clue as to what's going on the course, and there are no fans out there with Miller. They've crossed to the other side of the course. Miller's doing this all alone. You know, it can't be more than a half dozen people out there watching this magic taking place. But Miller has been very candid about this, because as Adam was saying, Miller figured it out. I've just birdied four holes. I was six behind. That means, well, those guys had not even teed up. I'm two behind. And then he starts saying, then I began to get a bit nervous. And though maybe he didn't really choke them, he says he kind of choked a bit with his putts on numbers five and six, which he had in really good position to birdie. And then comma number seven, he hits a great iron shot into 7 feet. And all of a sudden he says, now the pressure really got to me and I was just shaking. And he didn't come close to the hole on the seventh, so he missed a birdie opportunity then. Then he plays the very difficult par three eighth, hits the ball on the green. It's the flattest, easiest putting service. It's the only easy putting service in those days, at least, on the golf course. And he three putts. So he says, now I'm choking again. So Miller is, in fact, feeling lots of pressure. And as Adam said, anybody who thinks that Miller was just playing off on his own way, didn't have any pressure, could shoot what he wanted, just doesn't have a real sense of where Miller was in the tournament and where he knew he was and what he was feeling playing these difficult holes at Oakmont. So
yeah, as you said, he crosses when after that eight, he crosses back over the turnpike right in front of the clubhouse to play the ninth, correct?
Yeah, exactly right.
So by the time he gets there, and he did just drop a stroke, by the time he crosses back, everybody sees his score. You know, they had standard bearers back then. Everybody sees that he's three under, but right. He's right back in it. I guess if he was three under, he was three or two or three shots. The other guys had started by then. But
and then he birdied number nine.
Yeah, he birdies the par five ninth, which everybody seemed to birdie, which is now par four at Oakmont, if you're familiar with the course. I do want to – I mean, we just got into Miller, who's the star of everything and the ultimate hero of the story. But I feel terrible that we've completely neglected Lee Trevino through this. That's what happens when you have a laundry list of stars who are at the top playing so well. Without going too far, backtracking too far, Trevino, he had already won the two U.S. Opens. He had already won two British Opens. He was already, you know, one of the greats at the time. And he comes into Oakmont in 73. He's having a lot of personal problems, not too terribly dissimilar from what's going on with Tiger these days, about his personal life being problematic, and he had been through a lot. And you know, if you know the story of Trevino, we do a lot of background work with him and biography about him. He's really an interesting character, and it's too bad we can't talk about him. But if you pick up the book, you'll read a lot about him. He had struggled a little bit that year with some injuries, and you know, his personal life was kind of a mess. And he comes to Oakmont, which is just such a hard course, and he plays, Steve, I think you could back me up on this, maybe the most consistent four rounds of tournament championship golf anyone's ever played at Oakmont.
From tee to green.
Tee to green, his putting was a real problem. That's what he kept talking about. His putting kept him from winning the championship. But he plays just spectacularly. He ends up shooting 370s and a 72, which is incredible for Oakmont. But he's so consistent from tee to green and off the tee and staying out of trouble that he plays himself. He doesn't have that 65 or that 63 or that 68 even, but he plays himself through those first three rounds right into contention, and he's two strokes back heading into the final day.
Yeah, go ahead.
And he gets off to another one of those starts like he does, just making drive straight on the fairways and greens. And he struggles with his putter, and he didn't know Oakmont. He was one of the few guys in the mix who hadn't played Oakmont before. You know, Nicklaus had played it before, and Palmer had certainly played it before. He had no real understanding of the greens, as he said, and he's, you know, he was coming up short. He was always lipping out or coming up an inch short of because he couldn't figure out the speed. And the greens at Oakmont kept him from winning that tournament. I think it's fair to say, you know, the way he played. Tee to green is exceptional, and we may never see anything like that again at a course like Oakmont, but he still struggled with the putter, yet he's still in contention on the back nine. He makes a birdie at two, which actually pulls him right either one stroke or even with all the leaders. So he goes through the back nine and early into the front he goes through the front nine and early into the back nine right there, one or two behind. And if, you know, you can just get the sense that he's just sitting there. If I can make one putt, I'm going to win this tournament. And I can't remember. I think it was Herbert Warren Wind, who's one of the great golf historians, in one of his books says something like he saw Trevino make that a birdie putt at two, and he wondered if that was going to spark Trevino to the title, because all he had to do was start making putts, and you know what that's like for a major championship. So we left Trevino out through those first 3 days, but you can't leave him out once you get to the middle of the fourth day. So I guess that may segue you into Weisskopf if you want to handle him, Steve, because he's just as important as anyone else on that final day.
I have a question before we go on, because when you were talking about Miller and how much time did you get to spend with Johnny Miller while you were doing your research?
Not at all.
Really?
Johnny Miller would not talk with us. And it was a great disappointment.
Wow. Oh, okay.
We had great interviews with Palmer and Nicklaus, who were fantastic and very, very detail-oriented, and those were special. But, yeah, we did not get to Johnny Miller.
Did he give you a reason why?
The reason that we were given was that he was writing a book of his own.
Oh.
We fully respect that. It certainly is right to talk with somebody or not. And of course, we were disappointed, and we would always welcome an opportunity to talk with him at any point about things in the book. And we admire him all the more for, you know, his extraordinary accomplishments that we hope we've documented. But it was a disappointment. The thing about it, though, that allowed us to go forward was, you know, the Johnny Miller who would become the spectacular announcer, the path-breaking golf announcer starting in 1990, who would say what was on his mind, have acute insights into other golfers' minds, really knew the mind game as well as the technical parts of it, really understood golf courses. Well, that Johnny Miller didn't just emerge in 1990 when he started broadcasting. That was the Johnny Miller all throughout his career. And because there was such strong journalistic coverage of golf, through the 60s and the 70s period, Johnny Miller is speaking constantly in the press of the time period about his thoughts in general, as well as playing in particular. So I haven't met a reader yet of the book who hasn't thought that we must have interviewed Johnny Miller in great depth because of all the quotations we have. Well, we have all the quotations because they're genuinely from the newspaper accounts and magazine accounts of the time.
As you were describing this, I was convinced that you had spent a tremendous amount of time. And my question was going to be, because he is such a articulate announcer and opinionated announcer, how much of a picture painter was he now in reflection of all this? But okay, you didn't talk to him.
Well, we were fortunate, just as a side note, that when we were writing the book, the key part of the story, the time frame for us was around 2007, 2008. And we were fortunate that the Open came back to Oakmont in 2007. And since Miller is with NBC and NBC was covering the Open, there was a lot of a time for reminiscing for him in the newspapers and on TV. So he would sort of, you know, we were lucky that was sort of like indirectly interviewing him occasionally here and there.
Okay, we were listening and recording his every word.
Yeah, exactly. You're recording him speaking. So, yeah, it's just as good. Unfortunately, you're going, wait a minute, I have a question. But he's not going to be able to answer.
I think I saw him drive by on a cart. We went to the Open. I think I saw him drive by on a cart at that year, and I really wanted to shout out something.
I did too.
Johnny, just one question. I'm writing a book. Hang on. All right.
Let me just say something just to finish up with Adam was saying about Trevino. We have six. It's kind of an ensemble cast. We have six main characters, and you know, like Adam was mentioning before, Burroughs, Colbert, Gene Borak, Gary Player. We have at least a dozen kind of second characters who we develop to some degree also. But Trevino's story is second to none. And the thing about this 1973 U.S. Open in Trevino and his not ever being able to adjust to the green speeds at Oakmont, actually coming up short more than anything else because he was so afraid of three putting that he just kept coming up short. He didn't play at Oakmont the week before. He decided to go play this tournament in Philadelphia. Why he did that, I don't know. I guess he'd explain it himself. Was he was trying to make more money. But he knew when he was in Philadelphia that he should be at Oakmont, and he was getting angry, and the press in Philadelphia caught this. He was getting angry about his performance at Philadelphia. He was also angry that he was even in Philadelphia. So at the end of the third round in Philadelphia, he just quits. He says, I'm leaving. I'm going to Oakmont.
He gets in his motorhome and he drives to Oakmont.
He drives to Oakmont.
W.C. Fields had some lines about Philadelphia too, didn't he?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And the Philadelphia press were not happy that Lee Trevino left to go to Oakmont, but Trevino didn't care. The thing about that particular moment in time, though, also about Trevino, was that we have memories, by and large justified, as Trevino was one of the great showman, jokester, hail fellow well-met guys in golf. I think that holds for most of his career. He's one of the most special people that the game has ever seen. 1973, though, wasn't a good year personally for Lee Trevino for some of the reasons that Adam talked about. But in general, he had become very, very publicity shy. He was not happy with being a celebrity and having all aspects of his personal life talked about all the time. So one of the most remarkable things we found out, and I kind of did a double take and almost ignored it at the beginning, and then I finally decided that, you know, we have to probe this further. It turns out that Trevino was so upset about having to be with his fans all the time and having to confront the press all the time that he bought himself a mobile home. A couple of
Winnebago.
Open. Big old home, Winnebago. And he drove it to Oakmont and brought it into the parking lot. And the members said, you know, essentially, what is this? And he said, I want to keep this here. Anyway, they found an obscure place to put the mobile home near the driving range. And Trevino used that mobile home to hide from his fans and hide from the press the entire tournament. You couldn't find Trevino. He didn't sleep there. But he would not be accessible. He was really buckling a bit under the glare of publicity and trying to stay focused on his harder courses at Oakmont that I think he knew he should have been practicing on for the entire week before. He was trying to win his third U.S. Open in 6 years. He was really trying to make history. And Oakmont being as difficult a course as it was, with the premium on straightness, and Trevino arguably being the best ball striker of his era and the straightest player, really was going to be in contention at Oakmont, but he didn't have the little extra it took, and he was upset. And you can just see pictures of him on television and caught by the press. He's upset the whole time period he's on the course. He can't quite figure it out. So anyway, the Trevino story, he finishes tied for fourth. You wouldn't think he's central, but in fact, we make him central. Likewise, Tom Weisskopf, as Adam was saying. In the first segment of the show, we told your listeners a little bit about the competition between Nicklaus and Weisskopf. Weisskopf really lives under the burden of having been so close to Nicklaus, having very similar aspects to his game in terms of hitting it very far, hitting it very high, oftentimes the only guy who can hit high enough long irons to hold tough par fives like the 15th at the Masters, always being compared to Nicklaus and oftentimes falling short at key moments.
Especially at the Masters the previous few years.
Yep, Yep, I think Weisskopf ends up with four second place finishes.
Yeah,
at Masters.
But they're all within the span of like 7 years. That's what's interesting.
But the Weisskopf story is a very, very key one for us. No one had really ever written about Tom Weisskopf. We went to his grandfather's home in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, to the libraries of Massillon, Ohio, to the libraries of Cleveland, Ohio, even to his old high school library, to unearth all kinds of interesting things, not only about Tom Weisskopf, but about his parents, both of whom were golfing champions in their day. So there's a lot of personal dimension to Weisskopf that enhances the value of the kind of the story we tell, where to just kind of go fast forward on it. Weisskopf is in the tournament to the end. He's continuing to play great, and he just misses a birdie putt on number 17 that would have put him really in contention to try to kind of win at the end. But the man never stopped trying. His father's recent death was on his mind. Weisskopf had developed the nicknames of temperamental,
Towering Inferno.
Towering Inferno, Temperamental Tommy.
Those kinds of things.
He was in total control of himself during this 1973 Open. One couldn't try harder than Tom Weisskopf did, and he just fell a little bit short. So he's very much part of the story, and he finishes third. Okay, so now let's go into the Miller back nine, which we label the greatest back nine ever in championship golf. Miller made the turn in 32 strokes, four under par. He had five birdies and one bogey. He was not in the lead, but he clearly was in contention. Very few people picked up on that. His gallery still remained small. And Miller confronts immediately the 10th hole, which Dave Pelz, at the 2000, the putting guru Dave Pelz, in the 2007 Open, would label the 10th hole the toughest par four in America. Nobody in his right mind is trying to birdie the 10th hole. And in fact, Miller just plays that hole rather cautiously, plays it excellently, keeps the ball below the hole on a green where it's hard to be below the hole, makes a solid par, and moves on to the 11th hole. Well, that's the start of Miller's streak that is historic. Miller plays perfect shots onto number 11, leaves his putt in perfect position below the hole, sinks it for a birdie. Then they go to the par 5 12th, 603 yards. For most of the 20th century, the longest par 5 in U.S. Open history. Hits his only offline drive, goes into the rough with it. Very fortunately, gets a good enough lie to go in there with a 7-iron, chop it out, and leave himself about 185 yards or so from the green. Hits a spectacular 4-iron into a rock-hard green that was becoming more rock-hard all day. Stops the ball beautifully. Sinks the putt, again from below the hole, for yet another birdie. And now he's 6 under par for the day. 4 under in the front, 2 under in the back, 6 under for the day. Comes to the par 3 13th, pulls out his 4 iron again. Hits it at the stick. Frank Gifford, Marilyn Smith announcing it, go wild over the shot as it comes into the green. Lands about 4 or 5 feet below the hole. Again, uphill putt, no break to the putt, another birdie. He's 7 under for the day. Miller's going wild. People are starting to hear about it, and he's starting to approach the clubhouse. People are starting to leave the clubhouse to try to find Johnny Miller to watch him play. Comes to the short par 4 14th, one of the true birdie holes at Oakmont. Hits a great second shot into the green, leaves himself a very makeable 12-footer. He leaves it short. He can't believe he leaves it short. He's really upset. Tries the putt again. Anyway, walks off the green. Comes to the 15th hole, one of the great hole, kind of the signature hole at Oakmont at that time period. It's not a birdie hole. Miller smashes a tee shot, gets out to the fairway. The wind's blowing up a bit. Argues with his caddy a bit about what the proper shot is, what the proper club is. Miller goes to the 4-iron yet again and tries a very daring high fade shot into a right-hand pin. Puts it 10 feet away, again leaving himself an uphill putt. Sinks it, and all of a sudden, he is now 8 under for the day. He's got 3 more holes to go. There's a gallery starting to accumulate. It's growing by the second. And so Miller's, the next thing is, well, you know, will Miller be able to add to his lead? will he extend the lead? We can tell the story real quickly. He pars the 16th hole after putting his tee shot in the safe left-hand portion of the green, makes two great putts. And then on the 17th, the short par four that Jack Nicklaus, as Adam said earlier, had driven in the first round and tried to drive every day, Miller decides not to try that, not to take a chance. Hits a wedge shot about 12 feet from the hole, uphill putt, leaves himself perfectly, hits what looks like a gorgeous putt, just slips out on the right edge, misses the putt. He's very annoyed about it again. He knows he's got Arnold Palmer and Julius Burrows and other people chasing him. He wants all the birdies he can get. He's trying to shoot 62 or 61, but he misses there. 18th hole, hits his drive down the middle, about 10 or 15 yards farther than any drive he's hit all day. Comes in with a 5-iron at the flagstick all the way. Lanny Watkins is up on the green watching it. Lanny Watkins thinks he's going to have a tap-in putt as a result of the shot. But the ball hits a ledge on its way to the flagstick, backs up, leaves himself about a 22-footer. I went out and putted that putt at Oakmont myself. I tried it a number of times just to see what it was like. Miller hit a spectacular putt. It should have gone in. It lifts out 180 degrees. He's very annoyed, thinks he hasn't quite done enough to win, but he closes out with a 63, retires to the clubhouse. Lanny Watkins kind of greets him with a big smile, and there it is. Miller goes to talk to the press, comes out to talk again at the after he's done his formal interviews, and says, well, those guys are out there. They know what to do. Maybe they'll be choking among themselves. I'll just wait here and find out. So that's Miller's back nine. The first time that anybody in Oakmont tournament golf history, to this day even in 2011, has ever shot 31 on the back nine at Oakmont. Oakmont is so hard that no one's ever gone four under at Oakmont on the back nine except for Johnny Miller.
That leads in, you know, the image of Miller saying, oh, those guys out there are going to have to watch my score now that it's been posted and maybe some of them will choke over it. That leads us to the guys who – sort of backtracking a little bit to the guys who started the day in lead. It was the four-way tie with Jerry Hurd, Julius Burrows, Arnold Palmer, and John Schlee. And so they were the last two pairings. And I don't think we have time to get into what happened with Hurd and Burrows. So we're going to have to – that's for the listeners to catch on their own in the book. But the second last pairing is Arnold Palmer and John Schlee. And Palmer is still, you know, the guy everybody wants to see win in that sort of that swan song kind of moment. So he begins the day in the tied for the lead. You know, he's Miller's already made his four birdies, but Palmer and John Schlee start the final day out, the second last pairing. And it's sort of a strange thing to see Palmer, who's sort of the most beloved figure in golf at the time and maybe of all time, playing with this guy that nobody knew really anything of. He was kind of a lanky guy. He was kind of an odd-looking tall. He was in his mid-early 30s, but he already had gray hair. He was sort of an odd duck is one way that we looked at him.
And he's wearing this called a goofy Hawaiian shirt commemorating the Hawaiian Open that he won a few months earlier.
He didn't get the memo on the upscale attire that the other guys were wearing. So it's sort of a strain, and they're total contrast, these two guys. This guy's won one tournament in his whole career. Palmer's won, you know, 60, 70, and Palmer's this short, stout guy, very muscular, and Schlee's this lanky, tall fellow that people don't know anything about. And so the image of the, you know, choking on the first tee and under the huge pressure, that seems to hit Schlee right off the bat, who I can't remember if he slices his first drive and they can't find it off it. So he takes a second drive, which hooks way left, and then they find the first drive, so he has to go and he has to take a third.
Goes back to the tee.
Yeah, he has to go back. He takes – long story short, he needs three drives just to hit the fairway on the first tee. So his – everybody says, okay, well, this guy had a nice run the day before shooting 66. He's done. So, you know, let the big boys play. Let Miller, who's doing well, and Nicklaus and Palmer, all these guys. So people, you know, there's a sense that, you know, you forget about Schlee for a while. And you can watch Palmer, you know, either have a chance to win this thing. But without going into too much detail – the front nine doesn't play out that way. There's a lot of up and downs for Schlee. He pars a hole, he double bogeys the first with the tough three drives, but then he eagles the fourth. So he's up and down, and he plays his way through, and he stays in contention, like, shockingly. No, you wouldn't have imagined the way he started and who he was and who the course was and who the field was, that he stays in it and makes it all the way through the front nine with a chance, you know, one or two right behind. And the same with Palmer, who has a few ups and downs as well, but really costs himself a shot at, I think it's the 10th. But he comes back and he birdies the 11th with a fantastic approach from the fairway.
No, he doesn't birdie the 11th. Just a correction there. Remember, he misses that birdie putt on 11.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. He makes a fantastic shot from the fairway, and he misses that. That's what happens. I'm sorry. He misses a birdie putt. He has a 4-foot or 4 or 5-foot birdie putt that would have, he thinks, tied him for the lead at the 11th. But he has what he calls a sort of a triple punch to the gut kind of moment where he misses that putt, that 4-footer that would have, he thought, tied him for the lead. He goes to the 12th hole, and this is where things get sort of garbled on timing and everything. But that's where he discovers that Miller is shooting this fantastic round, the 63. And he realizes that he thought these other guys he had to worry about, and he finds out that he had to worry. Now he has to worry about Miller, who's shooting an incredible score that nobody shoots at Oakmont. So he's got to deal with that, coming off that bad miss of a birdie putt that would have, you know, really given him a grasp of the lead. And he drives off the 12th hole, which is this enormous long par 5, 603 yards. And his ball, he thinks he has a great drive. It kicks, we're not quite sure, it may have hit a sprinkler head, was one of the explanations. Drives in, it goes into the rough, and from there he's pretty much buried. He has trouble getting out. He has to take some medicine and chip out, and he has a couple bad shots. I think he three putts the 12th, which ends up with
a bogey.
Yeah, ends up with a bogey, which essentially costs him the tournament. I mean, he has a valiant, you know, keep playing and stays in contention, and he birdies the 18th, which is really a treat for the fans. But he's pretty much out of it with this sort of terrible turn of events between 11 and 12. But the interesting thing is that while that's going on, Schlee, who nobody knows and isn't any name compared to all these other guys, just keeps playing well. And I believe he birdies the 12th to get right back to it.
Adam, you think I can provide a little background on Schlee before you do the tale of the round? As we told your listeners in the first segment, they're going to find Schlee a very interesting character. We don't introduce him fully until chapter 10 of the book. But he is going to be as captivating as anybody coming down the stretch. John Schlee lived a very troubled life, a tragic life. He dies of Alzheimer's at the age of 60. But he was a force to contend with growing up in his on the west coast of Oregon. He was a person that people always remember, and oftentimes negatively. He essentially was a juvenile delinquent. He caused problems for law enforcement. He caused problems for the school. As we interpret it, essentially got a free pass for most of his antisocial and minor criminal behavior because he was a star athlete in several sports at his high school. When he graduates high school, he commits a burglary. He gets arrested for it. The judge gives him a choice, go to jail or join the army. He joins the army. He ends up being transferred in the army because he's not the easiest guy to contain in the army. Goes to college after he's done with the army, gets himself a couple of jobs as a club pro afterward, is thrown out of those. He's a tough guy to deal with. He's his own guy, and he's just not the nicest man. And it's a tough thing. It was a tough thing for us as authors to try to decide how realistically to portray John Schlee, given that he is key to the final round in Oakmont. But we tried to tell the story fairly and in a balanced way. And we've talked to people through all the different phases of his life. And I think your listeners will, if they, you know, open themselves up to a different kind of character, really enjoy reading about John Schlee. But let's turn to the culmination.
The thing about Schlee, just to do one more thing on the background that makes it him special. You know, I said that he's sort of this oddball character for his look, and he's not the great champion that Palmer and all these other guys are who've won major championships, a handful of dozens of regular tour stops. But the thing that's interesting about him is he was one of those guys who had to scrap for everything. You know, Palmer was a millionaire, was already a millionaire by 73. There's this millionaires club that Trevino had just joined, and Trevino had grown up in a poor background, and he was a sort of a story of, you know, the American dream making good. But by this time, he's already a millionaire as well. Schlee is this guy who has to go from tournament to tournament, scrapping. There's one story where his wife says something about how They worried they couldn't even get their kids Christmas presents because they were so poor. And he was trying to live this dream of being the tour pro, trying to make it as a tour pro, not something you think of now when these guys are getting, you know, huge sponsorships and even, you know, finishing 25th or 50th in a tournament, you still get, you know, $25,000. It wasn't like that back then. And Schley is sort of this guy who's really sort of playing for his life and playing for his career and his family. So he's – that's another reason why he's this outsider in the story that makes it sort of interesting for us as a person and as a character, but as a golfer too. So he sort of emerges as, you know, there's parts of him that you really don't like, but there's parts of him where you're sort of rooting for him as the underdog. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens on the back nine at Oakmont is while these titans of the game start to fall off, and especially Palmer, who he's playing with, start to fade during the back of the tournament on the last seven or eight holes. Schley stays with it, even though he's got a goofy swing, which we didn't even get to. He's got all kinds of strange theories on life, and he's an astrology buff, and he's got all these weird theories about how to play golf and how it meshes with your psyche. And he prided himself as being a Ben Hogan disciple, which is of some dubious stature. But he's the guy who keeps through, and he birdies the 12th, I believe, and he plays – the 13th and 14th and 15th, I think he pars, but he comes to the 16th, which is a really tough par three, and he manages to birdie it, which pulls him one stroke behind Miller. So he's got two holes to make up one stroke, and this is really the climax of the tournament. You've got Miller, who's already in the clubhouse with his 63, and you've got Schley, who nobody expected. You got these two guys who really, at the beginning of the day, nobody really expected. But you've got Schley with two holes to make up one stroke, and the 17th, that short par four. That Nicklaus could drive. What happens? He doesn't try to drive.
He lips. He lips the putt. He almost does want everything to make the birdie, but doesn't quite make it.
Yeah. It was a pretty lengthy putt, but he just came up short, if I remember correct.
Absolutely.
So Schley comes to the 72nd hole. He needs to make a birdie to tie Miller. And you know, Steve, you know the 18th better than anybody, so I'll let you take it from there.
I just want to throw this in this is so good. When the movie is made about your book,
yep.
And
knock on wood,
huh?
Knock on wood.
Well, you know what? It sounds like Schley is the perfect central character.
Yeah, he's really.
When you come to what movies are looking for, and where's the story revolve around? He's the character.
Anti-hero.
Exactly. He's the perfect character for the movie.
Jack Nicholson. Yeah, that's true. He really is. I mean, as great as Palmer.
Oh my gosh.
Palmer and Trevino are fantastic. I love their story. But the Schley is so original and so mm-hmm. unique at time.
That yeah, he's up. The unique character that the screenwriters are always looking for. How do you make this into a compelling story, not just, you know, like, wow, you know, this event happened.
Well, you're in California. Go take care of that for us.
All right. Well, wait a minute. Well, you know, guys, we're out of time, so we really can't finish. No, I'm not going to do that to you, but we'll talk about that later. All right. Let's wrap this one up because we are so okay. deep into this one. But
Steve,
it's
take 18.
Great,
take 18.
18th is one of the great finishing holes in golf. It is downhill then uphill. You can't. It's a blind shot into the green. It's got one of the most difficult greens I've ever seen. If anybody of your listeners ever gets to see Oakmont, they won't quite believe 18th green until they can actually see it in person. You can't see it on television. At any rate, John Schley hits a terrific drive. And exactly what happened to him in the fairway, we don't know. He had all kinds of strange stories later about what he was thinking. He almost fell asleep. Arnie had to wake him up. All this kind of junk that apparently preceded his shot. But he didn't hit it quite right. He hit it a little thin. Hits the green. The greens have turned hard by then. It scampers over to the back of the green, 40 feet behind the hole, into the rough. But it turns out the ball is sitting up on the top of the rough. And Schley always liked to chip around the greens with low irons. So he pulls out a 4-iron, and he's got – I've made this shot several times myself. I'd say the ball is going to break 5 times between him and the cup. But he figures it out. He takes this 4-iron, hits it low, and the thing about it is you watch it in retrospect, it looks like it's going in the hole. The crowd thinks it's going in the hole, and only at the last second does it turn away and miss by 2 or 3 inches. And Johnny Miller is right there. Johnny Miller himself is standing 25 feet from the flag, watching Schley make this shot. I don't think nowadays you'd have the person in Miller's position actually standing so close to the green, right to the hole, watching the final thing play out.
But no, he'd be standing in the clubhouse watching it on television.
Miller had been in the clubhouse, and he was watching it on television, and all of a sudden he realized that some guys were chasing him pretty close at the end, and he came out to watch himself. He left his wife and his daughter back in the clubhouse. But in any case, that's the culmination. Miller was there watching, wondering if he'd have to go out to play again the next day. And the thing about us for Schley, he's such an erratic character. It's a hard life story. He he'd fade into pretty much insignificance after this. But how hard he tried, how he didn't buckle under the pressure, he certainly wasn't the last guy standing that you would expect to see trying to win the U.S. Open and overturn, catch up to Johnny Miller, who just shot 63. So Schley, the anti-hero, almost becomes the hero at the end. But ultimately, of course, it's Miller, his fabulous round, the lowest round ever shot at Oakmont, lowest round ever shot in the final round of the U.S. Open, the lowest round ever shot in a major championship. A round that you just have to say, 63, people say, oh, that was Johnny Miller, 1973 at Oakmont. Or you say, Oakmont, oh, yeah, that's where Johnny Miller shot 63. You'd be hard-pressed to find more than a couple of more memorable moments in the golf than Johnny Miller's winning the U.S. Open in 73 with a final round 63. So that's our book.
Stamp.
Oh, that's it.
Let me say one thing about that. That is the 63, the final round is the highlight of the book for sure. That's the great moment in the great moment of golf that we point out. However, that's not the last page of the book.
You're right.
We spent for a couple pages, we look at the aftermath, immediate aftermath of what happened after Miller. After Miller shot, he was supposed to go home. He was supposed to go on to the next tournament. He ended up in Washington, D.C. and trying to meet with – and he was supposed to meet with the president. He ended up meeting with the vice president. But we sort of fast forward all those six guys in the later part. After the tournament, we wanted to see, how things changed, how things stayed the same, what happened to Palmer. Was that really his last ditch effort of being, a glorious figure? Was that going to be his last great chance to win? And turns out it wasn't. So we sort of spin forward about Palmer. We spin forward with Nicklaus. We spin forward with all these guys. But the thing that, we were touching on with Schley is we sort of do – there is a feeling of – we look at the next 20 years of his life. He died in 2001. So I guess we look at the last almost 30 years of his life. There is that sense that you can't help but come away with that thinking, how much different would his life have been had that chip at 18 gone in? If he beats Miller in a playoff, does his career sort of fall apart? Does his life sort of fall apart? Because his life sort of falls apart in the decade after that U.S. Open. There's the sort of the agony and the ecstasy of these moments for these guys, especially Schley. So the last, I don't know, I'd have to go back and look. It's around the last 100 pages or so is sort of what happened after Oakmont. And did Trevino get his life together afterwards? Did he stay, did he continue to be a great player? What did Palmer do? How did Weisskopf turn, did he fold after, he had a great run at winning his first and only major? Did he keep that momentum going? And it turns out he did, because he wins the next major at the British Open. So, as much as the story of the 63 and the story of that tournament at Oakmont is important, it's sort of what impact that had later for the history of golf, for these figures, and how, as much as anything, how that 63 holds up over time, which is something Steve sort of addresses. I'll hand the credit over for that to Steve in the sort of there's an appendix. It sort of takes a larger contextual look at the 63 itself.
Wow.
Well, what we do, as Adam was describing, and I think here it's fair to say that we had Mark Frost's ending to his book, The Greatest Game Ever Played, the kind of aftermath section, and we decided to do our own aftermath section in this last 80 to 100 pages about all these guys kind of over the next 20 years. And so we really put a lot of time into that, and we hope the readers like that fast forward. But we also do, for those
buffs who really get into the number crunching aspects of golf, we actually provide a couple of statistical analyses that I think your listeners would find interesting to to look at about the overall scoring and just how great was Johnny Miller 63 compared to any other round.
Well, and to because this is a members only episode, to our listeners, thank you for sticking out for this entire episode, and you probably listened to it in three different segments. But he mentioned Mark Frost, who also wrote the book The Match, and when we had Mark Frost on Golf Smarter, and he did the pretty much the same thing with The Match, as he came on and narrated the story, as you guys have so eloquently done today. Wow. Thank you so much. This was really remarkable, and it's you know, once you see a movie, you're like, nah, I'm not going to read the book. But after hearing your description on this, how can you not read this book? This is so fascinating, such a great story, and you want more detail on it. Again, it's in our Golfer's Mart, Chasing Greatness, Johnny Miller, Arnold Palmer, and the Miracle at Oakmont. Adam Lazarus, the student, Steve Schlossman, the professor. You guys were awesome. I really appreciate you giving us so much time. This was so much fun.
Well, we had fun, too.
Up next, we'll be visited by Marius Filmalter, putting master for tour players like Tiger, Ernie Els, Vijay Singh, Wai Yang, Trevor Immelman, and you get the point? That's Marius on the Yips. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.